I'm Matěj Skalický. This is Czech Radio News Podcast, Vinohradská 12. Journalists don't die, they're killed. They're not in prison, regimes locked them up. They don't disappear, they're kidnapped. These are the words of Thibaut Brutan, the Director General of Reporters Without Borders. Is the security situation for journalists worldwide getting worse? Thibaut Brutan is today's special guest on Vinohradská 12. It's Saturday, February 15th. Hi, thank you very much for joining us on this podcast. Great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
I'll pick out three of your quotes. We will discuss it and analyze it. The first one is, journalists do not die, they are killed. Those are your words. Does that mean that war journalists around the world are deliberate targets of attacks in armed conflicts?
We've seen a change in the past decades in the way, you know, belligerents, fighters behave with the press. In the past, journalists were like collateral victims, collateral damage. Now they are being deliberately kidnapped, deliberately killed, targeted. And it's something that's very worrisome because it makes journalism not only a witness, but also a pawn in the war or in the diplomatic games. That's not the role of the press, to be a token in a vast game, which is something that's not in a relationship with the press work. So we're very concerned, and we think that the responsibilities of armed forces, of also the politicians, is huge in there, because there are some practices that are jeopardizing the press, that are encouraging people to target it, and that should not be the case.
So the blue press vest is not a sufficient protection anymore.
We've seen even contexts, I'm thinking about Gaza, for example, where journalists report that when they engage in a discussion with the population, people don't want to talk to them because they fear that they're going to be hit by a missile because journalists are targets. So that's the exact contrary of how things should be. In the past, if you look back in the 1960s or 70s, journalists were consider like a safe people to be with. And that's the opposite that's happening now.
So speaking of Gaza, you point out that over 50 journalists were killed last year, most of them in the Palestinian territories, which you describe as the most dangerous place to work as a journalist nowadays. You have brought this to the attention of the International Criminal Court. Do you have an evidence of a violations of Geneva Conventions which recognize journalists as civilians in the conflict?
So yeah, it's very important to remind people that even though journalists might sound like a different category, they are civilians. So, which means that they should be protected like civilians, which means also that they have a life as civilians. And we are very, you know, cautious about the investigation we're conducting on the cases of journalists killed in Gaza. But we have lots of evidence that prove that obviously some journalists were killed as part of like massive bombing, but some others were like deliberately targeted. Very early on in the conflict, for example, we conducted an investigation on the case of Issam Abdallah. It was not in Gaza, it was in Lebanon. But, you know, it's an example of a journalist that was in a car and he was filming. The car was labeled TV. There had been like recognition planes over the car. So we don't understand how, you know, it's possible that it has been a mistake. It's obvious that there have been like two missiles fired at the car, which killed Issam Abdallah. So it's an example of how we work. We conduct detailed investigation on each case.
Those are severe accusations, and Israel denies that their attacks are deliberate on journalists. Did you discuss it with Israeli government or not?
So we have seen a switch in the way we interact with Israel Defense Forces. In the past, like, for example, in 2022, 2023 was a change, but we had conversations with the Israel Defense Forces, which is a very talkative army. Lots of armies in the world are very silent, but the Israel Defense Forces have this specificity of having many spokespersons. And usually when there had been journalists targeted or killed or attacked, we had sometimes an apology or in other times a promise of an investigation. Now we've seen a total switch, and on top of, you know, the accusation that we bring, we see that the response is a defamation of the journalists, saying that they were terrorists, they were part of Hamas, or they were, you know, having a camera on one hand and a Kalashnikov on the other one. And that is not true. That's preposterous. So that's why we're very worried by this switch of the Israeli Defense Forces. We were not accustomed to that.
Is it really not true? Because in October last year, the Israeli Defense Forces released a report claiming they had obtained information proving that at least six Al Jazeera's journalists have links with Hamas and Islamic Jihad. Al Jazeera calls these fabricated accusations. But this is not the first such a case. Does your organization intervene in such disputes?
We do. First of all, we think that any accusation made against journalists should be looked into because we do not want to defend a journalist that has ties with Hamas or is politically and militarily involved. That should not be responsible from our part. So that we're very cautious in looking into that. But when we looked at the so-called evidence of the Israeli Defense Forces, we were very shocked. Some of the so-called documents were, you know, photos of lists in a kind of Excel format with registration, enlistment dates, which are totally preposterous. I mean, I understand that, you know, you can't be an engineer for Hamas when you are below 12 years. That's what the document stated. So I'm not saying it's a fake document, but, you know, we do not take seriously these accusations after having a look, a contextualized look at this so-called evidence.
Also, the Israeli organization Honest Reporting accused some freelance photojournalists of having prior knowledge of the October 7 attack in 2023. Major global media, CNN, AP, Reuters, they rejected these claims. But reportedly, according to Washington Post, at least one of the media cut the ties with the photojournalists who faced those accusations. Has your organization examine the extent of which Palestinian journalists are independent of Hamas or not?
First of all, we need to say that the Hamas administration, when it was in power in Gaza, has been very hostile to the press. And it's very important to say it because it's really obvious that what Hamas wants is not journalism. It wants communication. It wants communication to serve its action, to serve its enlistment. Mm. And we've seen that during the terrorist attacks. There were some communication officers of Hamas filming some of the attacks. That's horrible.
That's basically propaganda.
That's total propaganda, yeah. It's obvious that there is a war of images that's being conducted by Hamas. And so we are, you know, very selective in the people we support at RSF, and we look into their past statement about their professional qualities, and we see two different types of journalists that we've supported, which are, I think, very interesting. We see, first of all, journalists that have had historically tied and been trained by international media, a lot of them, AP reporters, AFP reporters, Al Jazeera reporters as well. And they're doing a great job, and I think they have been defamated in many ways by some of the claims of Honest Reporting and other organizations. The others are self-made, you know, journalists that have taken the responsibility mostly via social media, but also in link with established legacy media outlets. They have decided that their mission was to report fairly, honestly about what's happening. So these are, I would say, the two main categories of journalists that we support. And they have done a great job because when, you know, the blockage of the Gaza Strip started, no media outlet from the outside world was able to enter. So the coverage of the conflict was mostly made by Palestinian journalists in Gaza. And they were really the honor of the profession during this conflict because, as I said, they are civilians, so they have to queue for water, they have to queue for food, they have to take care of their families, they have to relocate from northern Gaza to southern Gaza. And in the meantime, they continued reporting until exhaustion with very limited internet, with very limited equipment. And so we're very grateful to what they've done.
And that's still true, right? That Israeli government still doesn't want any international journalists to enter the Gaza. Only Palestinian journalists are operating in the area. And you want to open the gates for international media to enter the Gaza. Are you in a contact with Israeli government on this topic?
Absolutely, and we think it's important that this happens fast. You know, we can understand that the priority is, you know, humanitarian aid. We definitely understand that. But what we've seen is that, you know, there has been legal challenges or people legally challenging the Israeli Defense Forces' decision of, you know, closing the strip to the press, and they have failed. So we think that at some point under international pressure, if international pressure amounts and grows, the Israeli Defense Forces will be kind of forced to open. It's about time that we get to see from the international perspective the devastation in Gaza, also to tell the story of the populations from a different angle, and also trying to understand how the reconstruction can be operated.
Journalists are not in prison. Regimes lock them up. Those are your words again. Last fall, I conducted an interview with Alsu Kurumasheva, a reporter from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, who returned after 9 months in a Russian prison. She's now raising awareness of other journalists who remain in Russian prisons. Are you exerting any pressure on Russia to release these men and women?
It's difficult to exert pressure on Russia. I would say that Russia is exerting pressure on the rest of the world. And what we are doing is to campaign for some of these journalists. And we think that it's really important that chancelleries, governments, especially within the EU, make it a priority. And I don't want to sound like there is no hope. I mean, we sometimes intervene, work on cases that look hopeless. Alsu's case, for example, was a very difficult one. And Ivan Gershkovich, the other American journalist that was...
Who was released with her.
And we knew by the conversation we'd had with the White House and other administrations within the U.S. government that there was the possibility of an exchange of prisoners. What's amazing is to what extent this exchange of prisoner was conducted. It's, I think, one of the largest exchange of prisoner with the Federation of Russia. And we're very, you know, grateful to President Biden and the negotiators who enabled that Russian democratic leaders could be part of this exchange as well. The problem is that we're switching true journalists for true criminals. And that shouldn't be the case.
Do you have any information about another major prison exchange that's going to happen in a few weeks or months?
If I had one, I wouldn't disclose it.
We spoke about the one last year. Belarus journalists weren't in the prison exchange. Alexander Lukashenko is still president in Belarus. Your organization recently filed a lawsuit with the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity, especially regarding the regime's treatment of journalists. Do you think it can change anything, the lawsuit you filed?
International justice is a long shot. It takes a long time until it has any effect. But what's interesting, and we see that with, you know, pure metrics, it attracts international attention. And international attention on Belarus is much needed. We think that the conflict in Ukraine is a major conflict. It's one of the battlefields of journalism. One of its backstories is the exodus of Russian independent journalists. And another backstory is what's happening in Belarus. And we need to focus on these cases of journalists that are jailed, this really impressive move that independent journalists have done in exodus, in exile, and continuing reporting on what's happening in Belarus. So Belarus, to us, could be really a blind spot in the reporting of the press. So that's why we're trying to find any way to revive the interest. This kind of filing is very interesting also because we're trying to put shame on Lukashenko. What we don't want is a normalization of his position, of his presence on the international scene. We use this notion of crime against humanity, which might sound, you know, big, but it is legally responsible to use those terms because we are talking about a regime that has persecuted hundreds of journalists over the past decades. And also, we are seeing a systematic persecution of journalists. So all of that amounts to crime against humanity.
Is it possible to report at least somehow independently from Belarus right now?
What we have to understand is there has been a change in the way exile media operate. We are no longer in the Cold War. where you had like newsroom established on the other side of the Berlin Wall that were broadcasting information towards, you know, locked territories. Now the information circulates very weirdly but efficiently. So most of the Russian or Belarusian exile media still have sources in their home territory. They are still able to collect information, but also disseminate it back. And that's why we think it's very important to work, obviously, on the, you know, secrecy and safety of sources, mm-hmm. but also to work on the distribution of the information. Mm-hmm. RSF is operating a satellite package towards the Federation of Russia and occupied territories of Ukraine. It's called Svoboda. And, you know, it's important that Russian population is able to access free information. And there is lots of very interesting independent journalism being produced either by international sources or by Russian newsroom in exile. So we think, yes, freedom, safety is important, but we need also to try and break, you know, the silence and bring back journalism where it should be.
Back to Middle East with your last quote, journalists do not disappear, they are kidnapped. According to your annual report, 55 journalists are currently held hostage, many of them in Syria, where they were kidnapped by the ISIS terrorist organization. Since the change of the Syrian regime, have you obtained any new information about their whereabouts?
What we are concerned is that we have information about some of the journalists that we're looking for. But the vast majority of the other journalists, we have no idea what became of them. And it's a dramatic situation. We had initial hopes in the very first hours after the fall mm-hmm. of Bashar al-Assad. But with time passing, we're becoming very pessimistic. There are chances that the Bashar al-Assad regime has secured some of these journalists into their remaining territories in some of the territories that they control, or that they've been sent to Iran. All of that is something that, you know, require more investigation. We're doing it. We're trying to understand what happened in the final hours. And in the final hours, believe me, one of the concerns of the Bashar al-Assad regime was to try to hide its crimes mm-hmm. and continue persecuting journalists. Mm-hmm. In the very final hours, they were still trying to harass, silence journalists.
You said that some of the journalists were possibly moved to Iran in the final hours of the Bashar al-Assad regime. So they are in perhaps in Iranian detention, or
we don't know precisely where they would be, because what we are concerned is the fact that there is no official information. Mm. There is no Red Cross visit for all these guys. That's why we can send them hostages, because they are not claimed as prisoner by any force. That's the worst situation you can be in, honestly. And I have a great respect for the families of Syrian journalists, of international journalists also that have disappeared in Syria, because they're continuing campaigning for their loved ones. And as long as they will not be presented with evidence of what happened, they will continue. And it takes a lot of nerve to do that.
Do you follow the story of the American journalist Austin Tice? He was kidnapped near Damascus 13 years ago, maybe. It was a long time. He's been missing ever since. His mother has recently returned to Syria to find him. Do you have any updates about if he's alive?
Deborah Tice, the mother of Austin Tice, is really a friend of Reporters Without Borders. We have been campaigning for Austin since the beginning, since 2012. I think there's a lot of emotion around this case, because Austin was really somebody that, you know, showed and expressed how much he believed it was his mission to report freely. I have a personal connection to him in some ways, because we attended the same university in the U.S.
Really?
And Georgetown University.
You know, so you know each other?
I don't think so, actually. We discussed it with his mom, and apparently, you know, we never were in the same class mm-hmm. or anything. But yeah, he's somebody that has been one of our, you know, iconic cases in the past years. And, you know, I'm going to tell a story, apologies for that, but, you know, one of the most difficult moments in my life at RSF was when video surfaced of an American prisoner wandering through the streets of a small city outside of Damascus, and we thought it could be Austin Tice. So I had to make the phone call to his mom to say, Deborah, look at this video and tell me if it's Austin or not. And it was not. It's not a heartbreaking phone call. You know, my hair is raising on my hair when I'm speaking.
Right now,
it was really, really tough to hear her say, I promise you it's not my son. And deep inside me and my colleagues shared the same feeling. We were hoping it was a miracle. We were hoping it was him. Everything could make that possible, but it was not. So we're continuing.
And do you still have hope?
There's still hope. I think the Biden administration has made claims which are based on evidence that he had been kept by the Bashar al-Assad regime. And he's an asset. He's an American citizen. And, you know, for these guys, as despicable as it can sound, there is a difference between, you know, the cost of lives depending on nationalities. So he was stored in a secret prison. And we think that, you know, he could be part of those prisoners that have been moved in the final hours. So we will continue searching for him as much as we can and with, you know, means on the ground. And it's very important. We have lists of jails where he could have been, you know, locked. We have a list of witnesses that we are interviewing one by one, and we will continue until the end.
This is not just about Austin Tice. Reporters Without Borders, in your annual report, mentioned the story of the two Radio Cotton journalists in Mali who were kidnapped in 2023, as well as journalists abducted in Yemen by Houthis group. Given everything we've discussed today, do you feel that the global situation for journalists is getting worse?
It is getting worse, and you mentioned some of the cases we're working on. What's important to say is that there's this fantasy, which is very well positioned in fiction, of international reporters, but most of the price of reporting is being paid by local journalists, national journalists, and they're doing a great job in communities where it's not always easy to be a journalist. So we are very concerned about the assaults on safety of journalists. But one of the things that is important to understand is that you can save journalists, but if you don't save journalism, if journalism can't thrive, does not remain central in the public conversation, is not favored by politicians that respect its role, it's not that if journalism is not favored also in algorithm and that the tech chaos undermines its ability to reach its audience, all of that has been pointless. So that's why we need to mobilize for journalists, but we also need to mobilize for journalism as a profession, as a social responsibility, as something of value, in order to make individual and collective choices, whether it's about, you know, your education, your health, your political choices, all of that is something that is grounded in the information you get. And as far as I know, the most professional collection of information you can get is professional journalism.
So thank you very much for your answers and time.
Thank you so much.
That's all for today. I spoke with Thibaut Brutan, the Director General of Reporters Without Borders. Thank you for listening.